Welcome to the Bardolatry Podcast. This installment, we have a little something different for you. Our excuse is that we are all in grad school and did not have time to do proper research before we realized that we had to record this episode right before spring break. So instead of our usual conversation, we're actually going to do a little bit more of a recommendation format. You'll be hearing from all of us, giving you a couple of our favorite performances of some of Shakespeare's plays, as well as some of our favorite Shakespeare plays, and maybe even one or two we don't like as much. Despite the fact that the podcast is called Bardolatry, we like to think that we don't worship him unequivocally. Hopefully you've figured that out by now. So with that, I will switch over to Olivia.
Hi everyone, I'm Olivia. I'm part of the Bardolatry crew. And today, since we're breaking up our episode and talking about some of our favorite plays and adaptations, I thought I would make you all suffer with a little bit of talk about my favorite play, Measure for Measure. I know I've mentioned it before, probably multiple times by now, that I love this play. It's one of my favorite plays, I think, in Shakespeare's repertoire. But I want to get off right off the bat and say, you know, I don't love it because I love the characters or I love that, you know, the things that happen in it are good. Of course, threatened rape and murder are never good things. But I worked on this play as one of the four that I talked about, or one of the five that I talked about in my thesis in undergrad, and I love it because it's complicated. In my thesis, I'm sure I've mentioned it before, I talked about cross-dressing spaces for female characters in the comedies and the use of voice in those various spaces. And what I think I learned to love about Measure for Measure is that Isabella really only has her voice as her primary defense for navigating the world of Vienna. It's a complicated comedy in which kind of all artifice of potential cross-dressing is stripped away. And I think that when Shakespeare was writing this play, he was really thinking about cross-dressing as a tool that these female characters use. And the way I read it was, you know, what happens when cross-dressing isn't available to a female character anymore? What does that world around her become, and how does she have to learn to navigate it? And Isabella, as a character, doesn't have a mechanism to help her navigate the world of Vienna, and when she's thrust into it for her brother's sake, she can only really use her position as a novitiate, a soon-to-be nun, and her voice and her brilliance to help her navigate through this treacherous and dangerous, especially for a woman, very dangerous world. And she tries in vain to utilize her voice and her guise to help her navigate the world, but Lucio, who's kind of a trickster, practical jokester, kind of a jester figure, and Angelo, the would-be duke, who replaces the real duke temporarily, they both treat her, through their language and through the way they behave toward her, as a sexual object. And no matter what she says, and no matter how much she tries to remain this devout and self-autonomous individual, they time and again place her in this role of sexual object, especially Angelo, through his false declarations of love, or potentially false declarations of love, and his incredibly inappropriate and violent sexual advances. Even by the end of the play, where the real Duke steps in and supposedly saves the day, he still enforces this incredibly strict false order by setting up couples, as Shakespeare would do in a regular not-problem comedy, and then proposes marriage to Isabella in hopes of further pushing her into the female comedic character role that she's been trying to avoid this entire time. But I think in a brilliant moment for Shakespeare, Isabella balks. And she doesn't do it with words. She doesn't do it verbally at all. She just doesn't respond to the Duke. She just doesn't give him an answer. And I love that about this play, because I like to think in my reading of it that Isabella proves that maybe she can't get her way with her voice, and maybe she can't get her way by wearing a novitiate's garb and using it as a guise to get her away from this very structured male environment, male-dominated environment, but she can use the lack of her voice to get her way, or at least to get her point across. And it kills me because I haven't seen an adaptation of this play on stage myself, and I would love to. But I've heard and read about a few adaptations that I think handle this really sticky ending to the play very cleverly, because, you know, there's room for adaptation. There's room for, not adaptation, but there's room for choice here. You can make Isabella say yes through her actions. She can smile at the Duke. She can offer him her hand. I've heard of a movie that does that, and it ends on a happy, comedic note. And then I've heard of adaptations that take it in a more serious way, and then I've heard adaptations that leave it up in the air for the audience to decide. Two that I'd like to mention really quickly I really like. One is that when Isabella is left with the final decision, as soon as the Duke says his infamous line that I can't remember right now about proposing to her, taking her as his wife, out onto the stage walks four prostitutes on one side and four nuns on the other, showing a really drastic dichotomy of what Isabella's choices are. And she's left in the middle of them with a spot of light on her as the curtain closes. Another play that I've heard about that handles this question really well takes a more artistic turn, where they have an Isabella dressed in white and an Isabella dressed in dark gray. And the Isabella dressed in white, they're both novitiate garbs, but the Isabella dressed in white is the primary actress who acts out all of Isabella's scenes, and the one clad in dark gray kind of just follows her throughout this play. But at this moment, when she's left with this question, the two break apart from each other and start running in circles, and she's just left running in circles until the play closes and the curtain falls, which I think is also really clever because it hints at maybe something inside Isabella's character that we've seen possibly throughout the play, I'm not sure. But if there's, you know, if that dark gray clad Isabella represents a more deviant, dare I suggest, side of Isabella that might have a chance to come out and play at the Duke's proposal, will she go with that side of herself? Will she go back to the nunnery if she can, if the Duke would let her? I don't know. But I would definitely love to see an adaptation of this play myself. So I'm sorry I can't recommend any to you guys to watch on your own if you're interested in learning more about this play and seeing the whole thing yourself. What I can do, however, is recommend a movie adaptation of a play that I also really like. It's The Tempest, and I probably have talked about it as well, starring Helen Mirren as Prospera, a female version of Prospero. I think we might have mentioned this on a previous episode, but I want to touch on it again because it's a really great movie and one you guys can find and watch. I think it's available on DVD, or it might even be on Netflix, I'm not sure. I could check into that for you. But this is a great adaptation of The Tempest because I'm, with a male Prospero, I'm not a huge fan of him because I think he's kind of a blowhard and he's kind of bossy and he controls his daughter, and he doesn't really listen to Ariel, and he's kind of pompous, if played that way. I've seen versions where he's played as a gentler, more loving father figure, but some of his speeches are a little blowhard for my tastes. However, with Helen Mirren as Prospera, there's wonderful maternal chemistry between her relationship with Miranda, and you really see that mother-daughter relationship played up as love and concern, not so much a parent controlling a child. I also really love that the reasons for Prospero getting kicked out of his court change. You know, it's not so much he's practicing dark magic or the suspicion that his sorcery is evil, but it's the age-old gender stereotype of women can't learn. And they're not allowed to study magic or anything. And there's that really great, you know, gender dichotomy there between Prospera and her brother. There's also a really interesting play between Miranda and Prospera and Caliban, who lives on the island. And rather than it being a commentary on colonialism and slavery, which with a male Prospero, that's a very strong reading of those scenes between the two and Caliban. But here it becomes more of a gendered interaction where it's the two women against one stronger male figure. And of course, there's gender and racial issues that come into that when played out on that front, which is very interesting, and they do a very interesting job with it. And I think that's worth looking into as well. So that you will be able to find, and it should be available somewhere on DVD, I hope, I think. I actually watched it in a Shakespeare class in undergrad, and my professor was right. It was a great recommendation if you're itching to see The Tempest done in a slightly more unique way. Finally, I think I will end my spiel here by touching on a play that I've seen and read countless times that isn't quite my favorite. And surprisingly, that's Romeo and Juliet. Now, there's nothing wrong with this play. I've been taught it in undergrad. I've read it in high school. I've read it in college. I've seen two or three adaptations, both on stage and on film. The Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes version, I think, is one of the most popular that people go back to when talking about adaptations of this play that are on film. And I've seen it, and I don't remember it very well because I saw it in high school, but I remember the weird fish tank scene where they meet for the first time, and it's really bright and vibrant, and it's an interesting adaptation of that play. It took me a little bit to think about why this might not be one of my favorite plays, and it's not to say that it's my least favorite play. I haven't read all of Shakespeare's work, so I might have a play that I dislike more when I get to it. But I think the problem with Romeo and Juliet is that it's a little... what's the word? I've been overexposed to it. Let's say that. I think reading it in high school and not really understanding Shakespeare when I'm 14, and then seeing it just constantly being rewritten as a timeless love story, and it's, you know, this beautiful story of two star-crossed lovers, and when you're 14 you think, okay, I'll buy it. Maybe when you're 18 you think these children are stupid, and then as an adult you think, well, it's just been done to death, I'm over it. To that end, I will say I did see a version on stage that was very well acted out in Cal Shakes, which is a California-based production company that does one play every summer. And they did a beautiful job. It was a minimalist stage. The characters were fully absorbed in each other and what was going on. And it didn't feel forced, and the romance didn't feel fake. But I think that's the problem with the play, is that it's partly on me that I've been overexposed to it, and partly on the way it's fed to you. If you're just reading it, no, it's not. I don't think their love story is believable, unless you're analyzing it as a scholar. If it's done half-heartedly as a high school production, or in the Romeo and Juliet, Claire Danes, and Leonardo DiCaprio movie, I don't remember feeling invested in their love story. I don't remember thinking it was true love at all. I guess it depends on the way it's presented. Definitely read the play if you haven't. I'm sure even if you haven't, you've heard enough about it that you know the gist. You know what goes on. But if you can find an adaptation that's beautiful and elegant and finds a way to tell the story in a new, organic, heartfelt way, please let me know, because I would love to see it and talk about it with you. And I think, before I blather on much longer, I will wrap myself up, because I could talk about Shakespeare forever, and I have a lot of more movies that I could talk about and let you know that I love. But I'll leave it here, and I'll see you guys later.
Hi, I'm Katie, and today I'm going to share some of my favorite Shakespeare plays. Now, I couldn't decide on just one, because I have a few, and it just wouldn't be fair to just choose one, because I feel like there are a few that are worth mentioning. So I'm going to talk about my favorite play from each genre, so tragedy, history, and comedy, because they're all very different plays, but they all have their own strengths and kind of highlight some of Shakespeare's best moments, in my opinion. So, yeah, let's go. So, my favorite tragedy, and, you know, this may be cliche, but I feel like this is Shakespeare's most famous play for a reason, is Hamlet. Hamlet is just, I feel like Hamlet is one of the only protagonists that we really get inside the mind of. I feel like a lot of the other protagonists aren't as developed enough, or they don't always play center stage in their plays. So we really don't get to see as much inside their heads as we do with Hamlet. And I know people give Hamlet a hard time for coming off sort of as a whiny adolescent, but I think that's what makes him relatable, and that's what makes him human, is that we've all kind of been there when, you know, we've been in an environment that was unfair, and we kind of questioned the man and wanted to stick it to the man and just kind of wondered, you know, what good is it all for? Like, what is my purpose here? And Hamlet really delves into some of the most, you know, deepest, darkest material in Shakespeare, and I can really appreciate that. I mean, and not only is the protagonist great, but you have some great background characters. You have Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, who I don't know if you've seen Rosencrantz and Guildenstern is dead, but I definitely recommend it, especially the movie version, which I feel makes a lot more sense. Because of sort of the play within a play dynamic, which Hamlet explores the whole idea about plays within plays as well, and gets really meta on itself, which is also something that I appreciated about it. And then you have King Claudius, who I've never seen him played the same. It's always very interesting how whoever plays Claudius. I've seen him played as more of a sympathetic villain, and then I've seen him played as, like, diabolically evil, where in the scene where he's praying and begging for forgiveness, he seems sincere, and then when Hamlet turns around, he just has this sinister grin on his face. He's just, it's just really interesting, what people choose to do with this character. You have a lot of, you know, dark humor in Hamlet, which I appreciate. It's not, you don't feel like the whole time it's all gloom and doom, especially, you know, the mask scene, which is a very clever scene. If I had to nitpick something about Hamlet, I would say that I wish Ophelia was a more assertive character. And Gertrude, too, they're just, from what I've seen it played, most of the time they're just very passive and kind of victims of this whole tragedy, which I feel like is not the case with other female characters in tragedies. So that is my one complaint about Hamlet, is that I do wish the female characters were stronger in this play. But other than that, I think Hamlet is some of Shakespeare's most psychological storytelling at its finest, because I feel like Shakespeare isn't much of a storyteller. He's more of a linguist. You watch Shakespeare for the wit and the language, but not necessarily for the storytelling. And I feel like here Shakespeare is a lot more psychological with Hamlet, and he really gets a chance to explore that. And yeah, overall, I would say Hamlet is my favorite tragedy. Not by much. It was a tough decision. I also considered King Lear and Othello, but at the end of the day, I feel like Hamlet is the wittiest of the three plays, and therefore the most Shakespearean, because I feel like King Lear is a little bit too dark. There is some comic relief with the Fool, but the Fool has a very particular sort of comedy that often, at least on me, gets lost. So I don't... King Lear is a little bit too humorless, and I feel like Othello kind of goes from 0 to 60. So I feel like Hamlet kind of has this good build-up of suspense throughout, which is why it works the most of the three as a tragedy, I would say. So yeah, that's my favorite tragedy, and my favorite history would be Henry IV, Part 1. Now, I'm not a fan of Shakespeare's histories in general, but I think all the Henry IV and Henry V are very well written, and they're interesting and exciting and full of great characters. I mean, Falstaff, we got Falstaff from Henry IV, Part 1, so you have some of Shakespeare's most, you know, memorable characters in this play based on real history. What I like about Henry IV, Part 1 is that it really gives its character some depth and sets up a nice contrast between our protagonist, Hal, and his rival, Hotspur. Hal at first seems like, you know, this irresponsible, taking advantage of, you know, his father, the king, just, you know, off gallivanting with the likes of, you know, Falstaff and peasants, but it's actually the time he spends with the common folk that makes him a charismatic leader, which is why, you know, he's able to kind of emerge at the end of the play being a surprisingly good leader, because he was able to connect with, you know, the common folk, whereas you have Hotspur on the other end, who, you know, is a rule follower and who is very driven, but he has a very hot temper. So even though he has more respect from, you know, nobility, and therefore he feels entitled because, you know, here's Hal off being irresponsible, and, you know, Hotspur feels like he's, you know, he's the more responsible figure, at the end of the day, you know, Hal proves him wrong. And the great thing about Hotspur is he could be very one-dimensional about this, like some other villains are, like, this is mine, this is my own. But in the end, Hotspur even admits that, you know, Hal defeated him honorably, and Hal too admires Hotspur. So it's really nice to see a rivalry in Shakespeare that isn't completely one-dimensional. And so I like how these two characters contrast each other and how they start off in radically different places and then end up, you know, as equals. There's also a lot of humor with Falstaff, and he has a really interesting relationship with Hal, where I can never quite decide how genuine their friendship is. I think there's this one scene where, you know, it kind of foreshadows that, you know, Hal's going to abandon him when Falstaff is put to death later on, and it's just kind of like they know that this, you know, strange little relationship of theirs can't last forever. But there's still kind of like that deep respect between, you know, this old fat man and this young, you know, this young rambunctious, I don't want to say boy, because I get a sense, you know, Hal is probably, you know, a young adult, but, so yeah, a lot of people don't talk about, you know, the histories, except, you know, outside of, like, Julius Caesar or Richard III, which are very good plays, but I think Hal has the most... not Hal. I think Henry IV, Part 1, kind of has it all. It has drama, it has, you know, colorful characters, it has humor, it has history. It just kind of combines everything without feeling all gloom and doom. Like some of the, because the other histories do feel like tragedies, in a sense. And I guess, like I said, that, you know, King Lear and Othello were my honorable mentions for the previous section. I will say Julius Caesar and Richard III are my honorable mentions for this section, but, Julius Caesar too kind of suffers from its lack of lightheartedness, while And while I do think, you know, Brutus and Cassius are very good, well-developed characters, the play does overall feel a little bit unbalanced at times, and Richard III, while it has excellent characters and an excellent story, it's just far too long. It just drags on way too long, and there are too many filler scenes. So overall, I am going to go with Henry IV Part 1 as my favorite. And Henry V is good too, but it's less well balanced because it's more about this big battle, and that's really all the play is about. So I'm going to go with Henry IV Part 1. And finally, for my favorite comedies, so here's the rub. I battled with myself on these, and ultimately I could not decide on one, so I have two favorite comedies. And my first is Midsummer Night's Dream, and I will be the first to admit that, you know, Midsummer Night's Dream is not Shakespeare's best writing by far, but I could see this play every single day, and I would find it funny every single time. I mean, I have just seen Midsummer's, you know, plays, and I have the movie version, I believe it's Kevin. Is it Kevin Klein is Bottom? I always forget, but some, you know, really famous actor is Bottom, and that's an excellent movie, by the way. I could just watch Midsummer Night's Dream again and again, and it's just, like, that's the thing. It is, at the end of the day, it is a stupid comedy, but it is a stupid comedy that makes you laugh every single time. Like, you don't care about, you know, the main character's romance. You don't care about the plot. You just want to watch some fairy hijinks and all sorts of crazy shit. And that's what I really appreciate, is that I feel like it captures what theater was at the time for Shakespeare, you know, for the common people and the rich and everyone to just come together and just enjoy their culture and have a laugh and just be together. And A Midsummer's combines that. It combines characters of different classes, of different species, of, you know, different times. It supposedly takes place in Athens, but, you know, the characters are anachronistic, and it just kind of brings everything together to kind of have this timeless feel that anyone would find funny, no matter, you know, what time period they were born in. And I really appreciate it because it holds up. Like, there are other plays like The Merchant of Venice that, you know, well, it's a great story, it just doesn't hold up because we have different, you know, cultural views and we're more accepting, and what was funny is now offensive. But I feel like Midsummer holds up and is going to continue to hold up, which is why it's, you know, it accomplishes what it should as a comedy. It's not supposed to be a tragedy. It's not supposed to be a drama. It's not deep. It's, you know, this is what you watch to feel good. And that's why I'll always love it, because it is just flippin' hilarious. And then my other favorite comedy is Much Ado About Nothing, which is probably everyone's favorite comedy, because let's face it, Benedict and Beatrice invented the love-hate relationship, and they're such a good example of it. They are by far, and we talked about this in our ships, Shakespeare's best couple. They're just so, you know, that their banter and their wit and the whole, like, does he or she really like me, just like the whole sexual tension behind it, is just so enjoyable to watch, and I just love watching their relationship unfold. And just all the other hijinks that occur in this play. It's just, you know, the original romantic comedy before it got too tropey and the whole, you know, chick flick genre ruined it. But I'll always have a soft spot for Much Ado About Nothing. And that has the Kenneth Branagh movie, that's a great version too, which also contributes to my liking for it. If anything, I guess the only place where it kind of fails to hold up versus Midsummer's as a comedy is people do kind of get annoyed with the Claudio and Hero subplot, and I have to agree, it is very frustrating to watch. You know, it's frustrating to watch Hero take Claudio back after, you know, he was a complete, you know, ridiculous, whiny, possessive, immature asshole, and that is kind of hard to watch at an end of a play. Like, you have other plays like As You Like It, where it ends with, like, four weddings, and we can, you know, obviously Rosalind and Orlando are going to end up together, and we can accept the other weddings because they're lighthearted and funny, and, you know, what, okay, whatever, everyone's getting married, but here, you know, with the, you know, the double wedding at the end, it just kind of, it feels unearned. So that's my only complaint with Much Ado About Nothing, is that you really don't care if Hero and Claudia are going to end up together. It's really about Benedict and Beatrice, and I just wish that the, you know, the whole subplot was not took up less time, but it just, you know, it's obviously a ridiculous subplot. Oh yeah, and the watch. Who can forget the watch? That's the real comic gold of that play. I can't believe I almost forgot them. Like the Rue Mechanicals and Midsummer's. They're basically what make those two plays as far as the comedy goes. But yeah, I think that's it, and I can't believe I took this long to say that all. But yeah, those are my favorite Shakespeare plays.
All right, so before I get started rhapsodizing about any performances of Shakespeare that I love, I will say that sometimes I feel like a bad Shakespeare fan. I've always loved studying him in school, and I did write my undergraduate thesis on Twelfth Night and As You Like It, so I am a huge nerd, but I've noticed that I'm kind of hard to please when it comes to Shakespeare performances. As much as I can appreciate the language when I read it and study it, sometimes if I'm watching in a performance, long speeches can bore me. So I tend to have mixed reviews. Sometimes I really like parts of plays but feel like they drag. Sometimes I love the whole thing. Sometimes I don't like it. And I'm also picky in the sense that if you dumb it down too much, that also makes me angry. So I'm hard to please. I don't love every production I see, although I'm usually willing to go see them. So, I don't know. I guess take what I say with a grain of salt. But with that said, I wanted to just start out with a couple of my favorite productions of Shakespeare plays, and for the sake of you being able to go out and actually find these, I decided to go ahead and not talk about any of the live performances I've seen, since you obviously can't go back in time and watch those. But I have seen some live performances I really love, not touching on them today. First, I actually wanted to recommend Al Pacino's Merchant of Venice. Merchant of Venice is not one of my favorite plays. I have some issues with it, but I think it's really interesting, and I really actually appreciate Al Pacino's version a lot. I watched it for the first time in high school, and it brought out a lot of stuff, a lot of the serious nature of the play that I hadn't ever really considered before, and it made me feel a lot of things as an 18-year-old watching it for the first time. My personal favorite choice, I guess, in addition to like some of the historical context the movie gives, is at the very end when you have the happy Christians all like, oh yay, we did it, and you have the end scene where, you know, Jessica's kind of staring off into space, you realize she didn't get rid of her mother's ring, and then Shylock is standing outside the synagogue and the rabbi closes it in his face, and you just realize his entire life has been destroyed. That's such a dick punch for me, and I think it's a really great reminder that no matter what Shakespeare intended, there's some stuff that modern day people kind of need to take into account. So I would definitely recommend it. I think it's well done. I think Al Pacino does a good job. So I definitely recommend that. The other Shakespeare production that you can go see that I would really recommend is Kenneth Branagh's version of Much Ado About Nothing, which was one of the first Shakespeare movies I ever saw that I loved. Again, Much Ado About Nothing is not one of my favorite plays. I like it. It's very cute. I love Beatrice and Benedict, but it's not, you know, like, an amazing play. But that particular performance of it is so freaking great. The Emma Thompson-Kenneth Branagh chemistry is spot on. They get the Beatrice and Benedict thing completely right. And I would 1000% recommend it. I have seen the Joss Whedon interpretation of Much Ado, and I still think the Kenneth Branagh one is much better. I would vote you go see that over the new one any day of the week. Sorry, Joss Whedon, but the Kenneth Branagh one is better. So with that out of the way, I just wanted to kind of get into a couple of my favorite plays. Probably my favorite comedy has got to be Twelfth Night. I don't know if I've ever said that on the show before. The thing I just love about Twelfth Night is it deals with a lot of cool issues, and it kind of toes the perfect line between comedy and tragedy for me. I love these, like, completely ridiculous comedic moments between, you know, Sir Toby Belch and Andrew Aguecheek and the Malvolio thing. But then I love how at the end it all, like, starts devolving into tragedy, and you're like, oh shit, like, Malvolio did not deserve this treatment. I really like the, like, comedic value of the gender bending, but then how it's also taken seriously. I think it's really cool. And I really like all of the opportunities for playing with sexuality. It's actually one of the big things I wrote my thesis on, so I'm probably a little biased, but one of my favorite dynamics of the play is Viola's relationship with Orsino and Olivia, and how Olivia is technically in love with Cesario, but kind of in love with Viola too, and at the end when she snags Sebastian, you kind of get that sense that she's not just towing the straight line, so to speak. I think that's really great. I really like the inclusion of Antonio, and how his relationship with Sebastian kind of has this interesting tension to it, and I really like that Antonio's character is, like, a super manly dude who's not afraid to talk about his extreme feelings for another guy. I just think overall it's done really well. I think it has the ability to have really beautiful moments and really funny moments and really serious moments, and pretty much all of the productions I've ever seen of it have always been really interesting and different. So that's something I think is just really awesome about the play. I think it's really versatile, and I think it has a little bit of everything. So I definitely am a big fan of the Twelfth Night. After Twelfth Night, I feel like it's only fair to talk about a tragedy since I already talked about a comedy. I will say overall I tend to like the comedies a little better, which is maybe not the most fair thing in the world, but whatever. I'd say one of my favorite tragedies is Othello. I think Iago is basically the embodiment of a glorious bastard, a magnificent bastard, and I really like the racial tensions going on Othello. Sometime I really want to talk about how Othello translates to the modern day and some of the stuff going on in that play that's, like, actually super weird and interesting with race and the way people have watched Othello for hundreds of years. It gives a great opportunity for commentary on a lot of different things, and it really just has some great absurd moments in it. One of the things I like is how you can portray Othello a lot of different ways based on his, you know, acceptance of what Iago's doing. Like, how convincing is he really, or was Othello already kind of, like, unsure of his position? So I think there's a lot of cool stuff going on in that play, and I also think it stays pretty on topic, and it has some fun stuff going on. And then I'm gonna have to be not terribly interesting in saying that Richard III is probably my favorite history, just because his character, again, I really like those magnificent bastards. I tend to actually like the histories a little less as a whole. If I had to rank all my plays from, you know, like, favorite to least favorite, the histories would probably all be down in the second, bottom half of the list. Because I think they can only stay interesting for so long, because we don't know the characters. It's a little less like rehashing some fun stories you already know, and sometimes it's just like, why am I seeing this battle? Who's that duke? What's going on with that guy? I think that's one of the things Richard III falls prey to a little bit. When I went and saw a production of it with my brother, He loved the first half, and once it started getting a little more into the battles, he definitely lost interest. And I kind of agree with that. I think that one can get a little draggy, but as far as histories go, I would definitely recommend it. When I was actually looking at the list of plays, as far as my least favorite plays go, I don't know if I really have any. Part of it is that I haven't read every single play, so I don't think it's 100% fair of me to claim that one is my least favorite when there's other ones that I haven't read. But with that said, I will say that one of my less favorite plays, which is really strange, is Julius Caesar. There's some stuff about that play that I love. I love the Ides of March. I love the assassination scene. I love Antony's rousing speech. I think all that stuff is great. I think my problem is it's like half of a good play. I love the suspense building up to the assassination. I think all that stuff is great. I have never seen the second half of that play performed well, and I've always found it extraordinarily boring. I am really looking forward to the day where someone performs that, where they really, really hook me on the second half, and I just absolutely love it. But kind of, I think one of the tendencies with Julius Caesar is to kind of devolve it into like an old white guy standing around and like pontificating at each other type of thing, which is kind of the tendency of a lot of performances of Shakespeare's plays if you don't do them correctly. And it always just gets boring for me. So my main challenge to the world is to perform a version of Julius Caesar that does not do that in the latter half. I think there are interesting things you could do. And I get that that Caesar's death like has to happen earlier in the play, but it almost seems counterintuitive for a modern audience. So that's one of the ones I don't love as much. Other than that, you know, some of the histories I just can't always get on board. So that's really about it from me. Some of my favorite Shakespeare adaptations that are not actually just like word for word the play itself. I will of course have to give a shout out to Where the World Mine, which I already did, which is a lot of fun and I think captures the spirit of Midsummer Night's Dream pretty well. So I'm a fan of that one. So thanks for listening, everybody. Next installment, we are planning on preparing a little better. We want to talk about Hamlet and Romeo and Juliet and whether or not there's such a thing as overexposure of Shakespeare to school-level children. So if you are interested in checking that out or any of our previous episodes, you can find us, as always, at the website, home of Minerva Magazine, www.minervamag.com. You can contact us on Twitter at MagMinerva. You can find us on Facebook and on Tumblr and kind of on all our own individual stuff. Just drop a comment anywhere. We'd love to hear from you, what your favorite plays are, what your least favorite plays are, what your favorite movie adaptations are. If you have any opinions on Hamlet or Romeo and Juliet, we'd love to hear from you. We don't want to be just handing out our opinions with, you know, no care for what anyone else thinks. We'd love to start a conversation with anyone else who feels that they also like the Bard a little bit. And, updates every, we have three other podcasts in the Minerva Podcast Network, so we are every fourth week. So you will not hear from us again until end of March, early April. And before that, we hope to hear from you. Bye, everyone.